So our meeting of the Senate Finance Subcommittee on the Department of Education's budget, we're going to hear. Please turn off your cell phones, any other buzzing devices. We have Senator Gardner, Senator Stevens may be here, and myself, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Stevens, if he does come, we'll have to leave a little early because he's got an engagement, is my understanding. Now, Commissioner Hanley is not here, and we kind of stopped him last time. Is there anyone prepared to carry forward with some of the things we were talking about?
I meant to address that.
I'm sorry. For the record, Les Smart's Deputy Commissioner.
Would you like to get a chair and come up?
Well, it's going to be really quick. After that committee hearing, we looked at the topics he hadn't covered, and they fit within future meetings, so he will be here at future meetings in appropriate places to carry those on. And actually, next week, he'll be here, and we're covering some issues around the digital learning. And
yeah.
I think we can build it in at that time, and so that way we could focus this whole meeting on TLS. I apologize for not telling you that in advance.
Senator Gardner, you remember that? That we ended at the governor's initiatives that were within EED's mm-hmm. budget, and we get towards the end where we're talking about the digital learning and ACLIN. We never get through all that, so we need to do that. You think he'll be back at the next meeting to be able to do that, or
through our chair Dunleavy, he will be back. He is committed to that, and it's on his calendar.
Okay. So, any questions, Senator? Before we begin, we're going to go through the teaching learning support and.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So at this point, if we can have an overview of the Division of Teaching and Learning Support, and I believe in our packets, we should have Teaching and Learning Support towards the back. This is what we've got, correct? Is this what you
That's
have?
That's correct.
Okay. So please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
For the record, my name is Susan McCauley. I'm the Director of Teaching and Learning Support.
Excuse me, could you just move a little, pull that guy closer to you?
For the record, my name is Susan McCauley. I'm Director of Teaching and Learning Support for the Department of Education. And I'm going to provide a brief overview referencing the document that says overview of Division of Teaching and Learning Support. And then Mr. Prussing, Deputy Director, will walk you through some of the details. So we want to, of course, view our role as a division in connection with the department's mission. And the department's mission is, as stated, to ensure quality, standards-based instruction to improve academic achievement for all services, for all students. There are four core services of the department, to provide public school funding, to ensure the department's accountability fiscally and for compliance and oversight as connected to that, to oversee school effectiveness programs, and to engage in active partnerships. The division, the TLS division, really focuses on numbers 2, 3, and 4.
Okay, we may stop you periodically to ask questions.
Of course.
Okay. Are there any questions, Senator? I have a question. Number 4, your active partnerships, what do they consist of? Can you give us numbers, examples, please?
To the chair, those would be partnerships such as those with libraries, archives, and museums, with PTPC, the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, with the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, those sorts of partnerships.
Is the Military Youth Academy under EED?
I don't know the answer to that question. Senator Dunleavy.
We may need a third chair, huh?
That might be a good idea.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Les Morse, Deputy Commissioner, Alaska Department of Education. The Military Youth Academy is receives some of their funding that they receive through a formula within our formula grants at the department. So it's part of school finance and facilities, and it's one of the formula grants. It's laid out in statute, the amount of that grant. And so they receive funding from us. I don't know that it's all their funding. I do believe they receive other funding from other sources. And in that way, that's the only way that they're part of the Department of Education.
Is it considered a public school?
I believe it's considered a public school, but if you graduate from there, you don't earn an Alaska public school diploma. I think there's a military diploma, and many of the kids earn a GED after they've attended.
Does it have its own site code like other schools and school districts do?
It's not considered a school.
But it receives public funding.
It does, Chair Dunleavy, it does receive public funding through the formula programs.
Through the BSA?
Well, it's I don't know that it's actually part of the BSA. It's a formula that is in statute, and I don't know that we'd say it's part of BSA, though. No.
But it's public funding.
It is public funding, yes.
And it's not like EDGECOM. It's not. I don't see it on your R chart, so it's not directly under your jurisdiction.
No, it's actually part of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
And does it, so you get a GED?
Students may, my understanding, students may earn a GED by attending there, that they get support for that, but not all do. The students who are there are actually considered, one of the criteria to enroll is that you've dropped out of school. So in the public school system, the public K-12 system, they have dropped out of school when they enter there. There are young adults who leave there and then re-enroll in public school and go on to then earn their public school diploma. It's a pretty small number, but it is, some students do that after having attended the Military Youth Academy.
Do you know if they're required to teach to state standards or administer state assessments?
They are not.
Do they have certified teaching staff there?
I believe they do not have certified teaching
okay.
staff there.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other, I'm sorry, cut you off on the partnerships, or did you finish up on the partnerships?
I mentioned those that I intended to mention. Senator Dunleavy, if we could look at number two then, and the TLS division's responsibilities with regard to fiscal accountability, primarily in our division, those are with regard to federal programs and monitoring for compliance with those federal funds. With regard to school effectiveness as a core service of the department within the TLS division, our role there is implementation of academic standards, of academic assessments, and accountability systems that monitor student learning. And then, as we already discussed, with regard to active partnerships, I mentioned a few of those. The graph at the bottom of the page really is a very high-level picture of demonstrating that the majority of our funding in the division are federal funds. And Mr. Pressing is going to walk you through a much more detailed look at that picture. And at this point, I'd like to make room for Mr. Lewis, the Director of Administrative Services, who will work through the rest of it with you, with Mr. Pressing.
All right, for the record, my name is Paul Pressing. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Teaching and Learning Support. I plan on going over three documents with you today. Number one is the org chart. I'll just do a quick overview. The second document I plan on going over is just this graph, two graphs. And the third document will be this Excel spreadsheet that breaks out each of the component in more in-depth detail. I don't anticipate getting into this document, but it is here for a reference if we need it at some point based on some of your questions. Starting with the org chart, I'm going to go from left to right, and I'm going to start with the mint green, if that's what that is, Child Nutrition Services, CNS. And that is our free and reduced lunch program, temporary emergency food assistance program, the CACFP. Basically, the food programs within the state are run through the child nutrition program. The next team over is our grants team, in yellow. They're responsible for administering, making sure all the grants budget narratives are approved through the district level and at the state level. They do the quarterly reimbursements for districts, make sure the bills get paid. Then they send those over to Mark Lewis's shop, who then pays the districts and draws down the government G5 system. They handle approximately 850 grants currently. Very busy group, do a great job. Third team over is our assessment and accountability team. On the left-hand side is our research analysts. They predominantly work with data analysis, such as doing the AYP calculations and the school report card. The team on the right deals with unique assessments, such as the NAEP, the alternate assessment, and the ELL, English Language Learner Assessments. So that's the assessment group. Continuing on over in the red, we have the No Child Left Behind, or NCLB team. They predominantly work with Title 1, 2, 3, and 6 within the No Child Left Behind Act. it's referred to more commonly now as the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, ESEA, as reauthorized under No Child Left Behind. approximately a $32 million program. We'll get more in detail here in a minute. The blue team is our health team, and at the bottom, we also have our charter correspondence position. Our health team works with suicide prevention, and they used to have the Title IV funding, which they no longer have, but they also have a federal grant that works on some alternative school education programs. I apologize, I have a little bit of a sore throat, so.
Some water? Senator, sorry.
Thank you. I'm just trying to figure out under health, why do we have things like charter correspondence? What do these people do?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, structurally, since we have one, that's a state-funded position, the charter correspondence position, I stuck them with the health team so they could share support staff. So it's really just kind of a, thank you, for structural purposes is why they're there. What they do is they review correspondence school applications and charter school applications for the state. And they also monitor and review correspondence schools for the state.
Follow?
Thank you. A little confusing.
Quick question, CTE, did we get there yet?
Not yet. The third team over is the State System of Support, SSOS. It's in the brownish color. That is our only GF-funded team, if you will. They're tasked with turning around chronically low-performing schools and districts. They consist of three content specialists, one math, one reading, and one in science. And then we have an administrator and then a support staff and another education specialist working with those schools.
Thank you.
Senator?
Later on, and we can wait until then if it's going to happen, will we be seeing kind of how you measure success and some examples of the work that's done by this SSOS team?
Sure.
Okay.
I could, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. The third, moving forward, is the CTE, the Career and Technical Education Team. That, again, comprises of, it's predominantly federally funded through the Carl Perkins Act, and they do the Career and Technical Education thing program as administered through the federal Carl Perkins. And I'm not sure if you had a question.
What kind of programs and partnerships do you have on the CTE?
Well, most of that, the CTE is actually, it's a $4 million program. They're relatively small grants. The federal program has increased funding over the last probably 15 years. And really what it really focuses on is aligning career technical education courses within the content. So there's a tracking, they call them career clusters. So there's a sequence, say if you're going to take a welding class, for example, that you could take your sophomore, junior, and senior year in high school, that potentially you could have that that experience lead to a post-secondary welding certificate or an interim certificate, if you will, that qualifies you for further education within the career and technical education field. But they're predominantly fairly small grants to districts to help collaborate and coordinate those types of activities.
In all cases, are the instructors for, let's say, welding, are they certified teachers? In all cases?
For CTE, I think it really depends on a case-by-case by the district, what they're able to hire and what they're able to offer.
Are the districts able to hire folks that aren't certified teachers to teach these courses?
Well, I know in rural Alaska, it's always an issue of getting a certified welder who might have 15, 20 years of experience, but might not have a teaching certificate, but has a union certified welder, for example. And I know districts work in trying to get those types of people in the program, and more likely, they're more often than not supervised by a certified teacher.
Are there any instances where there's a school or school district that contracts out or has a partnership with, let's say, a labor organization or some other non-certified, non-school district entity?
Senator Dunleavy, not, or Chair Dunleavy, not to my knowledge.
Okay.
But it since it is up to the local districts to determine how they're going to run their program, it wouldn't surprise me if some collaborations within their communities may have occurred. But I can't speak to any specific example.
Thank you.
Moving on is the Yellow SPED team, Special Education. Again, they review the federal grants for compliance and monitor for special education compliance. The fourth team, or the kind of purple team, is our teacher certification team. They ensure that all our teachers are certified to teach in the state of Alaska. Down below that in the red is the AKT2, or Alaska Transition to Teaching. It's a federally funded program that ends this year, and that program will be ending. Below
question.
That,
Senator?
Alaska Transition to Teaching, is that people coming out of careers and moving into the teaching profession, and are there modifications on the certification requirements?
Through the chair, correct. It's someone who has maybe a BA in biology and wants to become a science teacher, and they're already living in a community, and the district would like to hire them. Commonly what we have is a husband-wife team in rural Alaska. Husband or wife wants to become certified. They get involved with the districts, enroll in the program, have a BA, and then over the period of time they complete the coursework and become a certified teacher.
Thank you.
Below that we have the early childhood in the blue. That's Mr. Sugar, who I'm sure a lot of you know, and our Head Start program, and also our new Parents as Teacher program. That's the blue team.
Question or two. AKT2, has it been a successful program from the department's point of view?
Chair Dunleavy, that would be a good question for maybe Deputy Commissioner Morris or the Commissioner. From my viewpoint, from a programmatic standpoint, I think for the limited time that we had the grant, we were able to do some great good things. We were able to get, I believe, 30, I don't remember the exact, 30 teachers certified. We had an impact on their retention rate in rural Alaska. But where there's some positive things, I could speak, that's what I can see. But
from the department's point of view, what is the view of AKT2? Are the grants running out? And do you have any plans of coming forward in the future, asking for money to continue the program? I'm trying to understand the success or the view of the success.
So in terms of actually bringing more people into the profession, I'd say it has been successful in that sense. But the cost of the program was fairly high, and throughout the grant period, we really weren't able to realize a way to bring those costs down. So in terms of being able to put forward something that to self-sustain that program as it was, would actually be a much larger increment than we would even be comfortable asking for. So we are trying to take the things that we learned from the program and begin. The commissioner is regularly now meeting with the deans of ed, the provosts, and trying to actually take the lessons we learned that were good, because there were some good things about some additional field experience before you have folks in classrooms in internships, or in this case they were actually being paid, and see if we can get those things built into the schools of ed. That's itself a challenging process, but in terms of keeping this program looking the same way would be more expensive than we think is appropriate to move forward.
Does the department think we have a recruitment problem or a retention problem?
Chair Dunleavy, there are some areas where there's recruitment issues, but I think it's just two areas at this point: special education, mathematics, and there's actually a third that we just reported to the U.S. Department of Ed, and I can't remember what that third was. But the issue, I think, from our perspective, is more around retention and maintaining staff and getting staff. And some areas, people are probably not going to spend their full career, but it's trying to get people to spend 6 years rather than four, or those kinds of things, that I think is an issue that we think is greater than the actual recruitment.
And I may be straying slightly afield, but has the department talked about, or are they looking at working with the university, whomever, to try and once again get an understanding as to what the retention issue is, and then coming forth with some concepts, some plans?
Chair Dunleavy, the state board is in some specific interests around really getting a handle on why teachers stay, why teachers leave, and so it's our understanding, I haven't seen the whole scope of the project, but our understanding that ICER, actually CAPER, which is part of ICER, all these acronyms, I apologize, I don't actually know what CAPER makes up, but it's their educational research division. They will be doing a study that actually is supposed to be delivered, I believe, this spring, definitely by June, that really takes a look at the issues and involves a lot of interaction with teachers about why do they stay and why do they leave, and we hopefully can get at that issue better. In the past, they've done studies on why people leave, but that leaves out the question, what caused you to stay? And it's a fairly comprehensive study from my understanding and talking to the director, Diane Hirschberg, of CAPER. And so I hope that gets at some of that issue, and the state board is actually very interested in that particular piece.
One more question. SB 241, is that something the department supports continuing? It's a University of Alaska issue, but what is the department's view on SB 241? Is that giving you any information, or do you see any of that information at all?
Chair Dunleavy, SB 241 being the report that they delivered to the legislature. We do have it, actually. I received my copy yesterday because we get copies in advance, and I asked our teacher certification folks to look at it. I gave one to Dr. McCauley, but I did not tell her why she needs to have that and review it. But it's because...
I'm sure there's a lot of things Dr. McCauley's been given lately that she's not sure why she's got them.
She's giving a lesson why a director doesn't begin it the first day the session begins. But we do take a look at that. It does provide us information in terms of our collaboration work with the university. And the state board is really pressing to have more work where they engage with the regents to really get at some of these issues. And the state board's issues are around teacher quality, preparing our teachers. And we've seen they've actually had their first joint meeting in my memory, and we go back until somewhere in the 90s since the two boards have actually met. And the chairs of those boards, along with the commissioner and the president, have been regularly meeting since then. So our engagement to try to push some of these issues and collaborate with them has increased. So I hope that that report actually does provide us information that we then can utilize by working closely together, or more closely than we have in the past.
Okay, and the only reason I bring it up is obviously it costs money to implement. There's a lot of staff time, and if CAPER is heading down the path of trying to find out truly the issues of recruitment, but more importantly retention, will SB 241 still be needed after that? Is the question. That's something we can settle down the road here. Any questions?
All right, continuing on. Pretty much completed my overview of the department. I have color-coded these, really kind of one for structural to show that for me to kind of track which federal programs most of these teams are predominantly working on. The next chart I'd like to go over is just a quick high-level overview, and then we'll dive into the Excel spreadsheet. These are the actuals from 2012, and it shows you a breakdown. Our TLS component breakout by line item, 87.69% of what funds that come into our division, it goes out as grants. We have 8.67 in services and about 3.21% of personal services. And that's our based on our actuals FY12. The chart below that is our component breakout by fund source. So 84% of TLS is funding is from federal. We have 5% GF and about 5.6% interagency receipts. And you see on the far right there are a little bit of a stimulus funds. We still have some 1003G money that we got an extension on, and we also had Ed Jobs that just ended in September 30th of this year. So that's kind of a high-level overview of our division, is where the funding's come from and where the funding goes.
A question. Sequestering, which is just around the corner. When you look at these graphs, one's left with the impression, if they're uninformed, that you almost look like a federal satellite office for the U.S. Department of Education.
Senator, or Chair Dunleavy, that's exactly right. I mean, we're predominantly federally, our TLS is predominantly federally driven. Most of these teams are federal monitoring and compliance.
So have the feds given you a heads up if sequestering does take place, what's on the chopping block for things that may affect your department?
Well, what we've been monitoring it really closely, and we have heard anywhere from 8 to 11% cut across the board. We have notified districts back in August of those potential cuts. Sequestration won't affect education funds till July 1 of this year, even though their impact aid, I think, is the only funds that will be impacted in March. But education funding will stay level through June 30th, and then July 1 is when they'll take that cut.
Would you anticipate you'd be coming back for some type of request for an appropriation, a supplemental? We're not there yet. We haven't gotten to that point.
Well, Chair Dunleavy, historically, when we have a decline in federal funds, we try to absorb it in the department either through non-hiring of vacancies or continue the programs with what funds we do have available. We've been fortunate up to this point where we haven't had a major reduction in federal funding that has had a personnel impact on the division.
One last question. Is there a way to find it? Can you guys find out if this does occur and you lose funding, will you still be required to support the mandates? Is there going to be a requirement to support whatever mandates we lose money for from the federal government by state funds? Can you find that out, if so?
Again, through the maybe Deputy Commissioner, but that's one of the things that's interesting about the federal government when funding ends, mandates still don't go away. So like Title II, for example, the Title II Ed Tech Plan, we no longer have Title II technology funding. But districts are still required to do that ed tech plan in order to get their e-read funding. So that would be a good example of an unfunded mandate that we still comply with because districts still get an added benefit of a reduced e-rate. So what we do is we try to do the best we can in the light of the circumstances, to be honest.
Okay, thank you.
So the third document is the Excel spreadsheet, and it was pointed out that this didn't match exactly the governor's book. If you look at the very bottom, I'm going to go to page 2, at the very bottom of the...
We're trying to find it.
Yeah, it's this.
Overview section?
In this book.
The overview section, page 10.
And the heading is Teaching and Learning Support Funding by Program. And if you could cast right down on page 2, it shows that your figure will show 106. This graph that Dr. McCauley presented, it shows 108. And there was a $2 million discrepancy in the Child Nutrition Service when the governor's budget was cast. The way Mark Lewis described to me is that we did an authority swap from school and student achievement to child nutrition because their programs have been expanding, but that didn't make it into the governor's budget. So
what's that? What'd you call it again?
An authority. Child nutrition programs have grown enough to where they're bumping up against their authority, so they couldn't spend any more money. So we adjusted authority from the school and student achievement and increased that into the child nutrition line. That wasn't recorded in the change record. So that's the discrepancy between this graph, anyway, and that book. But again, I just like to draw your attention to that bottom total. If you just go from left to right, you know, we have the first column is the 108 in federal, and then the 97 in federal and CLB. So those two components make up about $206 million of our $245 million budget. And I've been asked a lot about the $35 million in GF. And I think I really like this chart, because if you just back up, you can see exactly what comprised that 35 million in each component. You have the pre-kindergarten at 2, early learning at 9. You have a little bit of child nutrition, a little bit of teacher certification, the statewide mentor program at 3 million, the state system of support for 1.9 million, and then our student and school achievement, which is the biggest component, which is page 1 at 18 million. And if you turn to page 1, I think you can see the bulk of, I just wanted to point out that of that 18 million, 7.5 almost 2 million is our state assessment system.
Sorry, when you say page 1, what are you referring to?
10.
Page 10 or 11.
Page
10.
10.
Page 10.
Okay.
So you have page 10, 11 in your, okay. I apologize when I have the right page numbers. So if you back up to that 18 million, 7 million of it is right for the state assessments. We have 1.56, which are I guess I would call legislative add-ons. We have the Iditarod theme-based project at 500,000. We have the ANSET project at 960,000. And we have the AMREF, the Alaska Mineral Energy thing, at 100,000.
Questions? What is your unallocated carry forward? Can you explain that, please?
The federal money has what's called a tying amendment. So at any given year, we'll have three Title I grants, if you will, because they go for 27 months, so it carries over the fiscal year. So in order for that three-month appropriation from July 1 to September 30th, and those, we have kind of three grants, that unallocated carry forward gives us that authority to issue grants during that time period.
And what's our involvement with ANSEP? You've got a line item in here and you've got some money. Can you explain that, please? What does the department do with ANSEP?
From my perspective as deputy director, we give them the money. That's it.
Go ahead.
When this was brought, again, Les Moore's deputy commissioner, when this was brought into our budget, it was really, the request was to bring it in our budget to move it to them without any indirect at the time anyway. And so that's how it arrived in our budget was. The legislature at the time asked us to, if we would host it, to move the dollars to that program without an indirect.
Similar to the theme-based project.
Thank you.
So that really is the bulk of my presentation. If there's any questions about this Excel spreadsheet or any other charts, I'd be happy to answer them.
Do we do any work at all with detention centers, prisons?
Chair Dunley, Title I has a Title I neglected and delinquent program. Those youth detention facilities generate it's a very small amount, about $250,000 that goes to those facilities. Once upon a time, the corrections had all their youth youth that were convicted of adult crimes in Spring Creek Correctional Facility. I believe that's changed now to another facility, but that funding is broken up to those eligible entities.
Thank you. So are we onto the pencil page?
The pencil page.
Oh, that's the BSA. And for the record, Mark Lewis, Admin Services Director for the Department of Education. I did want to point out your question about youth in detention. There is a component under the K-12 formula programs. It's not part of TLS, it's part of the formula-driven programs, and there's 1.1 million in that category. The pencil chart is really just a representation of where the BSA has gone historically from 2003 to 2014, and it really is just there to demonstrate the amount that's allocated for the BSA. And then what we did do is we added at the top of the pencils where there was funding outside the formula. That means it wasn't part of the BSA, but there was still additional funding that was provided to the districts, what they call outside the formula.
Quick question, I hope. Back in, I think it was 2003, when I was still in another life doing a superintendent's, we worked with Senator Murkowski, and we also worked with AHFC, and we got a revenue stream for teacher housing in rural Alaska. One of the reasons we did that is before then, when we would get our allocated money, we would have to spend some of that on infrastructure, where some of the urban school districts did not. They could use their dollar for dollar for instruction. We had to use some of that money for infrastructure. Do you know if the school districts have to use any of their instructional money to pay for any of their infrastructure even today? Or is that a revenue stream that comes through AHFC or comes through some federal grants? Do you have any idea? It's not your departmental issue, I understand. It's a funding issue, but.
Just again, Deputy Commissioner Morris, in working with districts, I have some knowledge, but not a great deal, so I'll go a little bit into it. But there are districts that, particularly around teacher housing, that have to use their money. What there still is available, low-interest loans that they can secure from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. That's really the extent of my knowledge around that. It's really an Alaska Housing Finance Corporation program, but I do know that districts have to use some of their funding to, you know, secure the loan and then get those loans and then obviously pay them back, but at a low interest.
Thank you.
The only other thing that I think would be useful to cover is Senator Gardner asked a question about SAS. I didn't know if we wanted to make sure we address that in terms of the state system of support. You asked about the programs they do as well as some of the measurements, and it might be useful for us to cover that now if you want to do that. Or would you? And actually, the other person I'll trade seats with is Dr. McCauley, because this is an area she does know, even though she's relatively new to the department, because she has worked with the state system of support quite a bit and probably can describe some of their activities as well as anyone at the table.
For the record, I'm Susan McCauley, Director of Teaching and Learning Support. The state system of support currently serves three districts with a total of nine coaches, and each coach spends a week every month on site.
Three districts.
Each coach spends a week every month on site, most of them working at the school level at one school, and one coach also working at the district level. And prior to my joining the department, I was serving as a district level coach in Fort Yukon.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So this is something that came out of the lawsuit and the settlement, that the state would intervene in three districts, and the districts are paying for those services. Is that, am I remembering correctly?
Go ahead, Mark.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, it was in response to the lawsuit. Initially, we received some funding, and it went to the commissioner's office is where we located the initial appropriation. It was about $1.4 million. There was a bill with a fiscal note where we were in the process of going through this lawsuit, and what came out was the fact that under the Constitution, the legislature has the responsibility to maintain the system of public schools. And one of the things that was highlighted in the lawsuit was that we needed to have the ability to intervene and intervene sooner when we're, as well as have the fiscal oversight. And so what the legislature at that time provided funding so that we could go into these districts and provide assistance using state general fund dollars to do that. So the districts aren't required to use their funding to do it. They saw the need for the state to do something. And that's kind of how this whole state system of support began.
Thank you. Do we have any idea how long it will be necessary to continue it? Are there any other districts that we think we might need to provide the same services to in the foreseeable future?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, the The metrics regarding when a coach's service or when a district's status as an intervention district are not hard and fast metrics. We are certainly looking at student achievement data. We do 3 times a year data briefings, high-level data briefings with the commissioner. In many instances, getting some basic infrastructure in place that allows us to count on the data, the student achievement data, is a coach's first job. Getting in place screening mechanisms such as AIMSWeb, which monitors early literacy skills, are often the kinds of things that coaches begin working on right away, so that we are then able to have more than once a year data systems where we can look at that. We're also looking, though, not simply at quantitative metrics. We're also looking at the qualitative factors that contribute to having good systems in place. What is the degree to which there is good, consistent professional development in place? What is the degree to which there is cohesiveness between district office objectives and how those play out in schools? What is the degree to which there are systems in place for curriculum and assessment, professional development, and those kinds of things? So we use a planning tool called STEP, another acronym, and we monitor certain criteria that are indicators of that kind of district and school health, as in addition to student achievement metrics that indicate whether or not we're moving the needle on student learning.
So that begs the question, are we?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I would say in a cumulative fashion, if we are going to look at statewide mandated assessments, the movement is slow. We are looking at the things that are going to give us more of an indicator more than once a year. We're looking at AIMSWeb scores, for example, of first, second, and third graders between September and January. We are seeing positive indication that the efforts of coaches are making a difference. The moving from something like getting AIMSWeb in place, having the assessments actually be given, having the assessment data actually be inputted, that's a word, into the system, and then the long-term impact on student achievement isn't something that happens overnight. So I don't mean to not answer the question directly. In a sense of significant movement on SBAs, it's slow. In a sense of the indicators that will contribute to movement on those, we are seeing change and growth in the districts.
And how long has it been, 2 years that we've been doing this?
It began in 2007, but
time flies.
But that was when there were 5 intervention districts and only 5 coaches. The model too has undergone some restructuring in response to what we're learning about what other states are doing. And I see you have a question, I'll stop.
Yeah, so we had 5 districts in 6 years and 2 districts have dropped off. So do we know what was different between the districts that we are no longer providing intervention services for and those districts for which we still are? Did they start at a different place? Were the services different? Were the results different? I mean, how did we get here?
Please.
Through the chair, I could take a stab at that one. I think the 2 districts that dropped off wrote, I think, through the process of, through the commissioner. But what they had is, one of the things that we looked at is, as Dr. McCauley mentioned, is do they have a well-defined curriculum? Are they providing consistent professional development? Have they had a relatively low turnover rate? Have they had a superintendent there that's been there for a while and providing some stability within the districts? Northwest Arctic and Yukon Koyukuk met that criteria and also were showing signs of student growth, pockets of it. And they were implementing the model. They didn't want any additional services from the state. They appealed to the commissioner and it was granted. The other 2 districts, or the other 3 districts, have yet to apply for such a waiver. And they're also, I think, from, again, not just purely student assessment scores. If we look at structurally, UConn Flats is This is the second year with the same superintendent. In the 5 years that I've been involved with this program, actually 7 years, they have rarely had a superintendent for more than 2 years. So we will continue to assist that district in increasing their capacity around a well-defined curriculum, good instruction, the use of data. So that is an example of why we have it and still providing those services to Yukon, Koyukuk. Lower Yukon, I think there is potential that next year they will submit something to the commissioner. They've adopted a core reading program. Now we have to, you know, provide that technical assistance to make sure that they actually use it across their sites and are using it well. And they but they have those mechanisms in place. It's now if they can just use it in a consistent manner.
Do we have data about improving test scores from the children in those school districts?
Through the chair, again, we're seeing pockets of success. You know, it's really kind of comes down to that, I hate to use the word fidelity of implementation, but teachers that are using the well-defined curriculum and have the professional development, the training, we are seeing an increase in their reading scores, for example. Fort Yukon, I just looked at this morning, their reading scores have gone up over the last 2 years based on they've been working really hard on implementing their program and using data to drive their instruction, and they're starting to see some of those gains, and that was just shared with the board this week to our state system with our state system of support administrator Brad Billings. So we are seeing pockets of that. But what we are seeing, though, is that other districts are watching what the state is asking of these districts. We're providing, Dr. McCauley provided training in the Curriculum Alignment Institute for the last the last two Curriculum Alignment Institutes, assisting districts on making sure that their curriculum is aligned. So it's not necessarily just those intervention districts this team is working with. They are reaching out and having more of a statewide impact on how do you get your curriculum aligned, how do you use, we've seen increased use of the MAPS data, which is measured progress. It's a formative assessment similar to a DIBELS or an AIMS web type assessment. So we're seeing those kind of six domains, if you will, of the state system of support spreading across the state, which is, I think it's a long-term investment, and we're in it for the long haul, and we are seeing pockets of increase in student growth.
Well, I would just say it seems a little anticipatory to discontinue the services based on some kind of, like, a superintendent or a second year in a district that hasn't had more than 2 years, or pockets of growth when we're looking for much more than pockets of growth.
A couple of questions. Thank you for coming. This education, as you know, is front and foremost on a lot of our minds this year. And do we have any schools that concern you as a department in terms of performance?
I think that would be a commissioner question.
Why don't you pull up another seat? Well, there's plenty of seats here. Do you have any schools that concern you as a department? Do you have schools that concern you as a department in terms of performance?
Chair Dunleavy, again, Les Morse, Deputy Commissioner, for the record, absolutely.
You do, and these are public schools.
Absolutely.
That are publicly funded and publicly watched and under the public school system.
Absolutely, and actually our state system of support is working with some of those. I'd say there's other schools as well that the state system of support doesn't work directly with in terms of intervention, but those are districts and schools where we've worked to get them at the Curriculum Alignment Institutes. We've been doing providing other supports. So you know, one of the things that we do each year is we look at all of the schools across the state and we do what we call a desk audit. And from that desk audit, we actually sit down, it's usually by audio conference given our vast geography, but sometimes it's in person, but every school that would be considered low performing in some regard, we sit down with the superintendent and the principals and we talk to them about what are they doing. We talk to them about how they're leveraging their federal dollars and those kinds of things to try to get at the gains that we would hope that they would achieve. So I would say we put a pretty significant effort into
not only looking at those schools, but trying to make sure the right things are happening to cause, hopefully, change.
And I want to go on the record by saying I think you guys are doing a fantastic job. This is a systems question I'm asking. It's not a personnel, it's not a people dropping the ball situation. But as I mentioned, there's a lot of discussion. There's going to be a lot of discussion about education, what works, what doesn't, what approach works, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a public school system in which we have schools that many of us, including folks here at the table from the department, feel are not serving children to the extent we think they could.
Senator Dunleavy, I would say that's true, and that's when we make decisions either to intervene. We definitely work with those districts around what is happening to change things in those systems.
And there was a component within NCLB, I'm not sure if it's changed at all, but there was a component one time in there where if there was a failing school, as by NCLB criteria, there was actually money set aside to allow those students to go to other places, correct?
Chair Dunleavy, that's true. It works to some degree it works in primarily our urban areas because it has its limitation. If the next available school is 50 miles or more away, or it requires a flight, obviously you don't have to implement that under that rule. So it's particularly used in places like Anchorage, Fairbanks, Matsu. We do have students in those places where they use that choice and move to another school.
So a child, let's say, for this discussion, in Upiat School District, if there was a school out there that was under NCLB was considered a failing school, that child would not have funds to be able to go somewhere else to get an education. Is that what I'm hearing?
Chair Dunleavy, that is correct under the law. What they have instead of choice to go to another school is the supplemental services where they can have additional support after school by a non-school program. And in this case, it's usually distance ed with a program. There's multiple programs, but CERC runs one of them. They get that provision of the law implemented a year earlier than the choice piece when choice is not available.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
Do we know how effective that option has been in improving student learning?
Senator Gardner, are you talking about the choice option or the supplemental services?
The supplemental services.
I think we collect some data on that, but I don't know if you know more, Mr. Pressing, what data we collect. But we can go back and definitely provide what information we do have on that. I don't know if we have data on it.
Through the chair, I know we have extensive data reporting requirements, mm-hmm. and it would surprise me if one of our 45 data files that we submit doesn't have something on the SES. So I don't want to speak out of turn. I would have to go back and look at what that data has been gathered over the last couple of years.
Thank you.
We can get that.
I'm going to ask one last question here. Not really, for the moment. Are there any public schools that come to mind, but you don't have to name them, that you would be concerned about sending your own children to? You don't have to answer it if you don't want to. I'm not asking for a particular school or district.
Well, I'm not going to name school. I had a child in the Juneau schools, and I was very particular about everything, including which teachers he had, and was a strong advocate. So I tell you, if I were looking at a school, I'd be examining it very closely for a number of factors before I make a decision. And even within that system, I think it's important that parents have the latitude to use options like distance ed or other options that are available. So
exercise choices.
I think, we have choices that people do exercise right now, and I don't think that we have any policy issue with that.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks.
So that pretty much wraps up my presentation about TLS. I guess the point that I really wanted to make, though, is that if you look at this org chart, is that when we hear stuff like when I hear stuff as the deputy director, what are you doing about a school? I really I unfortunately have a predominant federal lens. I mean, we go out and we monitor for federal rules. We tell the districts, here's the strings attached if you take this money, and if you don't like it, don't take the money. I'd like to say that, but I don't. But and so I think a lot of the things you hear about the department from the districts really is more about the federal programs monitoring compliance, because that's predominantly what TLS does. Mark Lewis's shop doesn't go out and monitor districts. Elizabeth Noodleman's shop doesn't go out and monitor districts. TLS does. Mm-hmm. And I think we really do an amazing job of securing the funding for the schools. I still believe that the cost of operating these programs far outweigh the benefits at this point.
Say that again, please.
The cost of operating these programs still outweighs or the benefits still outweigh the cost.
Okay.
And you can see by the personal services line. It's very efficient. 3.3% of our budget is personal services that actually run $200 and some million worth of federal programs.
Is that entire chart now under the tutelage of Dr. McCulley?
She's the top box right there, Senator Dunleavy.
What's next?
That's all I have.
That's the TLS piece, but we want to make sure we've responded to all the questions around TLS that you might have, the teaching and learning support. So,
I have a feeling.
However, we will be coming with other pieces, like early learning has a component where we're going to just focus on that, and that's part of TLS. So there are some pieces like that that we'll come back with, but I don't know if there's anything else within TLS where we have increments outside of the new initiatives that we need to finish up on.
Any additional questions, Senator, at this point?
Oh, thank you. No.
The other thing I wanted to say is assessment's a big piece of this, but we do have assessments that we're going to be doing a presentation on next week as well.
Just a couple things. I want to go on the record saying that I think you folks do a very good job. It's a very tough job. You're kind of a caught in between a series of different forces colliding, and for me it's a systems issue. So when I'm asking you questions, it may sound like you're on trial, but that's not at all my purpose. And there's just issues that are going to come up this year and next year that are, I think they're very good issues. We're all trying to do the same thing. We're all trying to provide the best possible environment for kids to succeed in. So we're trying to peel back layers and understand things. I do have to prepare you that as we go through this year, questions that we were asking, there'll become more of those and deeper, and you will be part of the process, I'm sure, as we go through these processes. So I don't have any additional questions. Look forward to continuing the discussion on the budget and future education questions as well. So next meeting is it tomorrow? No, it's the 5th.
27th.
Oh, I'm sorry, 27th. Got my dates. Yeah, I got my dates. So we'll be back in the Senate Finance Room on the 27th at 3 o'clock.